Kia ora, and thank you for those kind words of introduction. It is a considerable honour for me to be asked to speak to you, and I want to begin by giving you the greetings of Sir Owen Woodhouse, who is, of course, in Auckland, but who is, of course, keenly interested in this subject, as he has been for many years. The second thing I want to do is to apologise to you for an address which tends to be on the heavy side and fairly closely argued, and I do apologise for that, but that is generally my style. Secondly, I want to apologise for the fact that I cannot remain for the remainder of your conference, because tomorrow I have to launch the panel's report, the Wellington Regional Local Government Review Panel, which I chair, is launching its report on the future of Wellington tomorrow, so I have to attend to that. Now, when I began writing this paper, I realised that I'd been involved with accident compensation in one form or another for more than 40 years, and that sort of came as a somewhat distressing fact to me. But can I say that what I've called this paper is, what can New Zealand learn from its 40 years of accident compensation history? Because it's 40 years since the first Act was passed in 1972. So what I'm trying to do in this paper is to look back at our history to see what it can tell us about the future. Now, of course, it's always a dangerous operation to do that, but I think it's quite important, because I think that New Zealand has forgotten what its own history is. Because our scheme remains unique, it was first enacted in 1972. It replaced, of course, the system of the law of torts for compensating personal injury. That method was trial by jury in what is now the High Court. Negligence had to be proved. That was something of a forensic lottery. As a young lawyer, we used to regard it as a sort of blood sport, doing jury trials for personal injury. And if the plaintiff won, he or she secured an award of damages and a single lump sum. Also replaced by the accident compensation scheme was the older Workers' Compensation Act that went back to 1900. Now, of course, it provided low periodic payments limited to a period of 6 years, medical expenses, and some modest lump sums. Workers' compensation required proof that injury arose out of and in the course of the employment. I remember as a young law clerk going to the Gear Meatworks one day and defending a compensation claim where the chap got himself drunk on Friday night and then went to work at 4 o'clock on Monday morning and fell over, saying he injured at work. We didn't win that one. But you can see how drawing the lines was a very strange and artificial business. Now, a tort is, of course, a civil wrong, and negligence actions were governed by the common law. That is, decisions were made by judges over the centuries and followed by later courts under the doctrine of precedent. The great tort of negligence arose pretty late, probably really in an effort by the judges to meet the changing social and industrial circumstances. And New Zealand, along with many other common law countries, repaired the legal injustices for worthy recipients who wanted to recover damages by providing two compulsory systems of insurance, one for employers and one for motor vehicle owners. Now, the Royal Commission, because if you didn't do that, there was no pot of gold at the end of the common law rainbow, you see. There was just no one could pay the damages. So the Royal Commission that reported in 1967, chaired by Sir Owen Woodhouse, did produce a revolution. All tort law was to be swept away, whether it was for accidents at work, on the road, at play, or anywhere else. And virtually, the report said, no new money would be needed. It would all be paid for out of the funds that were compulsorily exacted to fuel the tort system and the workers' compensation system. And that was because those systems not only denied many people adequate compensation, they cost a lot to run, and the money was chewed up by insurance companies and by the costs of litigation. And the basic thrust of the Woodhouse reforms was to collapse all the existing programs and replace them with one comprehensive, coordinated system of earnings-related compensation for all incapacity arising from injury. The scheme provided 24-hour protection for all accident victims without the need to exact new taxes to pay for it. Now, that was something of an Indian rope trick in policy terms, and took a lot of absorbing by the system. That report of the Royal Commission attracted much attention overseas. It inspired Gough Whitlam, the Prime Minister of Australia, to invite Sir Owen Woodhouse to chair a similar inquiry there. And that inquiry started shortly before the time the New Zealand Accident Compensation Scheme began to work. I was fortunate to meet Sir Owen Woodhouse when I was a law student at the University of Chicago, and I drove him back to his hotel in the Loop after a very pleasant party at the University of Chicago one night in an uninsured 1955 Chevrolet, since Illinois didn't require compulsory insurance. And when I returned to New Zealand in 1969, I was asked to write the government white paper, or commentary as it's known, on the Royal Commission report, and that was really as a result of the judge's suggestion. Now, the report proved to be a very big policy to swallow without some more aids to the political digestion. And so working with the officials in the Department of Labor was my first experience and my first exposure, really, to the New Zealand policy-making process, a process I have seldom been free from since. When the Woodhouse inquiry began in Australia, I was summoned there by Sir Owen from the University of Virginia, where I was teaching, to become the principal assistant to the Australian inquiry, and that was a memorable experience indeed. The Woodhouse inquiry in Australia was more ambitious than the production and replacement of the tort system. I just want to read you the first two paragraphs of the 1974 Australian report. This report is concerned with the responsibility of society for the injured and the sick. Its theme is their need for automatic rehabilitation and compensation, without tags and without discrimination. The recommendation is for generous earnings-related compensation at every level of income up to $26,000 per annum. In 2011 Australian dollars, that would be $186,000. In consequence, the present social security system of pensions that aims merely at an income for subsistence would need to be replaced. At the same time, the new scheme would supplant the action at law based on fault, and the general system of workers' compensation would disappear. In the absence of risks relating to these remedies, there would, of course, no longer be a basis for any form of compulsory insurance. Social problems in the past have been handled in a piecemeal fashion, but half measures and compromise are quite incapable of meeting modern needs and reasonable aspirations of disadvantaged citizens. The obligations of the community should be thought through from first principles. The report attempts to provide that analysis. It proposes a new deal for every Australian whose life has been disrupted or damaged by injury or disease. Now, when the Whitlam administration fell in 1975, the legislation that we had fashioned had reached the Senate, but the legislation fell with the Whitlam administration, and had Sir John Kerr's intervention not taken place, it quite likely would have been enacted. Now, but New Zealand's accident compensation scheme remained, and it has been through many iterative policy ups and downs in the 40 years since it was first passed by Parliament in 1972. What has remained constant has been the failure to avoid discrimination in the treatment of public programs that relieve the consequences of some misfortunes and not others. One lottery replaced another. The person laid low by cancer or by heart attack is treated much less generously than the person who suffers an accidental injury resulting from the same incapacity. Now, the explanation for why this occurred is simple enough. First, in 1975, there was an election campaign in which superannuation for people over the age of 60 was the single most important issue. And that led to the introduction of what was an extremely generous universal scheme that effectively removed the issue of financing an extension to accident compensation principles to sickness. It really took it off the table for many, many years. Expenditure on the aged in one hit went up more than 57%. The second reason for failure to act, although less important perhaps than the first, was the fact that the Royal Commission of Social Security in 1972, chaired by Sir Thaddeus McCarthy, had not recommended anything along the lines of the 1967 Woodhouse report. There had been suggestions made to Sir Owen Woodhouse by officials that he chair the Royal Commission into Social Security, but that did not occur. In light of this history, it is, I think, worth examining how the Woodhouse reports, both in New Zealand and Australia, envisaged the relationship of the bold new accident compensation scheme with the rest of the income maintenance system. And what this will tell us, in my view, is that New Zealand has made some unfortunate decisions in relation to the administration of accident compensation. Those decisions have not only produced a poorly administered accident compensation scheme, they've also prevented coherent policy from emerging. The Woodhouse reports can be best understood as a superior system of the type proposed by Lord Beveridge in his 1942 report, Social Insurance and Allied Services in the United Kingdom. The report made suggestions as to the measures to adopt when the Second World War was finished. And Beveridge made this observation, and I quote, "The advantages of a unified social security are great and unquestionable." Now, I am sure an interesting analysis could be carried out in New Zealand on the significance of various name and organisational changes that the ACC scheme has been through, and indeed that the income maintenance system has been through. We once called the income maintenance system Social Security, and we had a special Social Security tax, and we had a Social Security department in the days when the accident compensation scheme was devised, and it administered benefits under a piece of legislation called the Social Security Act. Later came the Department of Social Welfare, established by the Department of Social Welfare Act in 1971. And in 1992, there was a major restructuring of the department into five business units. And in 1998 and 1999, we got the Department of Work and Income and the Ministry of Social Policy. In 2001, the Ministry of Social Development arrived with the amalgamation of the Ministry of Social Policy and the Department of Work and Income. Now, in light of that very strange history, we ought to examine what the Royal Commission actually said and what it actually recommended. Because what happens in these things is that the mists of time envelop most policies that survive for lengthy periods, and those mists produce misunderstandings, myths, manufactured explanations about what was done. So it has been with the Woodhouse report. The accident compensation reform was adopted by a national government and legislation passed in 1972. When Labor won the general election that year, they extended it to non-earners, as had been recommended by the Woodhouse report. But there have been different approaches over the years between National and Labor as to what the appropriate accident compensation policy should be. It was at the beginning bipartisan. Both parties still agree on the major policy issue, that is, a return to the tort system would be wrong and should not occur. They agree on that. But on issues of administration, there have been divergent views. It is not now well understood that the original Woodhouse blueprint was never followed in important respects, and that dates from the very beginning. If it had been, some of the cost issues that have arisen in the life of the scheme would not have happened. The report recommended very limited compensation for the very first 4 weeks of incapacity, where the incapacity lasts no more than 8 weeks. In 1981, I presented a paper to the Triennial Conference of the New Zealand Law Society in which it was pointed out that the adoption rate of Woodhouse policy, as recommended in 1967, was about half. Of 36 major policy issues, the Woodhouse report prevailed in 17. Successes include such vital matters as the removal of the common law action for damages and the principle of earnings-related compensation as opposed to flat rate benefits. There were major policy issues upon which the Woodhouse approach did not prevail. These included administration, the appeal mechanism, limitations on the amount of short-term compensation, compensation for permanent partial incapacity, the method of raising levies, especially differential rating and penalties, which the Woodhouse report was against, widows' benefits, and a notional earnings floor for non-earners. Another matter that is relevant in light of more recent experience flows from the manner in which the Royal Commission envisaged claims being dealt with. At paragraph 309b of the report, it says, and I quote, "Informal and simple procedure should be the key to all proceedings within the jurisdiction of the board. Application should not be made to depend upon any formal type of claim, adversary technique should not be used, and adrift to legalism avoided." End of quote. Much could be said about these issues, and people interested in the history of the policy decisions should read a book I published by the Oxford University Press in 1979, which is called Compensation for Incapacity, A Study of Law and Social Change in New Zealand and Australia. But for present purposes, I'll concentrate on the issue of administration. Indeed, it has been in the administration that the most serious difficulties that have confronted the scheme over the years have their origins, I believe. It may be instructive, therefore, to compare what was recommended with what actually happened. Fundamental to the logic of the scheme was the recommendation that the insurance company should pay no part in its administration. At paragraph 15, the Royal Commission said, quote, "The principal reason is that such a comprehensive and compulsory scheme of social insurance could not reasonably be handled by private enterprise," close quote. The scheme was founded on the principle of community responsibility. Directly or indirectly, everyone must contribute to it, and clearly it should be handled through an agency of the government, the Royal Commission said. "It is our opinion," they said, at paragraph 209, "that private enterprise can have no claim to handle a fund such as a compulsory fund in New Zealand, which has arisen not because employers have been persuaded to provide the business, but because Parliament has ordained that employers must do so." The prime reason for this, in the Royal Commission's view, was inefficiency. The Commission pointed out in paragraph 480. 5.4, that administration and other charges absorbed, quote, as much as $40 for every $60 paid over to successful claimants. Now, following the original conclusion reached by Lord Beveridge, the New Zealand Royal Commission said the solution lay, and I again quote them, in a completely unified scheme for disability without demarcation by the cause of disability, close quote. The scope of the field was physical misfortune. This led the Royal Commission to its view expressed in paragraph 249, quote, there would be a great advantage in the integration of a comprehensive scheme of accident compensation into the present Social Security framework, close quote. After a discussion of the difficulties of reconciling the Social Security approach with the earnings-related approach, the Commission said, quote, some form of income-related benefits will be introduced as a modification or supplement to the present Social Security system, close quote. Now, the Commission has also made some observations on compensating the sick as long ago as 1967. They said at paragraph 290, it's possible to argue that if incapacity arising from accidental injury is to be the subject of comprehensive community insurance, then interruption of work for reasons of sickness or unemployment or other causes which cannot be guarded against should be equally included. Now, despite the attractions of the argument, the Commission reasoned it couldn't cross that bridge at the time. Nevertheless, it was clear that the relationship between accident compensation and Social Security was so close that integration ultimately was essential, and the administrative arrangements recommended by the Royal Commission reflected that point. And let me just read what they said about administration in their own language. Thank you, that's helpful. Quote, the scheme outlined involves a partial merger with some aspects of the present Social Security system. There are important differences in principle, however, and the general philosophy of the scheme has no exact parallel elsewhere. We think, therefore, it should be brought to life and set upon its course by an independent authority whose whole responsibility it would be to ensure the successful application in every respect of that general philosophy. It must be provided with all necessary administrative arrangements nonetheless. With all these considerations in mind, and just listen to this language, we recommend that an independent authority be set up by the government which should operate within the general responsibility of the Minister of Social Security and be attached to his department for administrative purposes. That never happened. The Royal Commission did recommend that the authority should be under control of three commissioners, and that was because of the powerful influence of the Ontario Workmen's Compensation Board on their thinking. But the key point was that the scheme was to be associated with the Social Security scheme as it was then known. Now, it didn't happen. The Accident Compensation Commission was established, and one of the early decisions it made was to appoint the State Insurance Office as its agent to receive claims around New Zealand. The Act contained power for the Commission to decide on the appointment of agents, and it negotiated with all of the insurance industry. But in the end, it appointed a single agent, the State Insurance Office. Now, of course, the issue was complicated by the change of government in 1972 and the necessity to extend the coverage of the scheme to non-earners and to do this quickly. And the decision to use the State Insurance Office, though, I contend, sent the wrong signal in terms of Woodhouse principles. The National Government decided during the time the policy issues were in front of the GEAR Committee, which sat for a very long period and was very influential on the final policy outcomes, that it wished to avoid any suggestion that the accident compensation system was connected to the Social Security system. Thus, the Department of Social Welfare was omitted from the Interdepartmental Compensation Committee, and the Minister of Labour and his ministry were the main drivers in the decisions leading to the parliamentary passage of the legislation. The connection with Social Security was severed then, and it never returned. Even when the Labor government extended the scheme to non-earners before it began to operate in 1974. Lawyers and trade unionists who'd been active in the common law system certainly had viewed with some alarm the possible involvement of the Department of Social Welfare. Now, the first big effort to revise or amend the scheme came in the late 1970s. And I wrote in my 1979 book that the administration of the Act does not match the vision of the original blueprint. The style of administration has too often been characterised by an abundance of caution, stubborn inflexibility, and an undue sensitivity to public criticism. I see no reason to revise that judgment in retrospect. But the scheme did accomplish successfully its big policy point, the biggest one, the removal of the common law action for damages. Now, it was in 1979 that a National Government Cabinet Caucus Committee began a full-scale review of the scheme, led by Derek Quigley. Two bills passed on the recommendations of that. Two bills were introduced. Now, one dealt with the administration, and it passed quite quickly. And the other cut down the benefits and contained a number of controversial changes, the most important of which did not survive the Select Committee scrutiny. I was serving on that Select Committee. I greatly enjoyed it. The administrative change was to abolish the Accident Compensation Commission and to substitute for it a statutory corporation presided over by a board. The board was part-time, but a full-time managing director was provided to control day-to-day administration. This was overseen by a policy unit in the Department of Labor, which became the main policy advisor to the government on the scheme. And indeed, the department had been central in the policy-making process from the very beginning. And Section 267 of the Accident Compensation Act provides the board now for not more than 8 members to be appointed by the minister under the Crown Entities Act 2004. In 2003, I looked at this situation, published a paper making a judgment on those issues, and I said this. By setting up an independent Accident Compensation Commission of 3 commissioners in the first instance, and later a corporation, neither of which were organised as part of the core state services in New Zealand, the accident compensation system has become something of a policy orphan within government. The Department of Labor maintained responsibility for policy development, but in practice this was developed by the commission and later the corporation itself. There is now a small coterie of officials in the Department of Labor that provide that advice. The policy generating capacity of the ACC turned out to be somewhat haphazard and unsatisfactory. Further, the organisation was left aside from deliberations within the core government departments for long periods of time, with the result that there was no integration of policy advice within the workings of central government. Now, if I can say, bring that a little bit up to date. The administrative problems that have been encountered by the accident compensation scheme over the years would, in my opinion, have been avoided to a substantial extent if the original policy prescription had been followed. At the outset, the Department of Social Welfare should have been made the claims agent, not the State Insurance Office. The corporation itself has not been a success. It is an outlier within the government system. The controversies that have beset it in recent times have been the result of poor decision-making, poor direction, and slack administration, coupled with a failure to appreciate the central nature of the scheme, or the essential nature of it. Over time, efforts have been made to turn the scheme into something that it is not and was never meant to be. Having a board has not, in my view, added value. A Department of State would never have behaved in the way the corporation has done in respect to recent controversies. it would have been better to hand the administration over to a Department of State operating on the conventional principles of ministerial responsibility, which is the linchpin of our constitutional system. Neither do I think the Department of Labor has been an effective advisor. It has no obvious policy expertise in the area and has not been able to provide advice to avoid various policy disasters that have been visited upon the government. The problem is structural and will not be cured until the structure is altered. One further point. The Royal Commission report stressed the primacy of accident prevention and rehabilitation of accident victims as having priority over the issues of payments of compensation. That aim has never been achieved, and that is most unfortunate. New Zealand never received what was envisaged by the Royal Commission, which was a, quote, unified and comprehensive scheme of accident prevention, rehabilitation and compensation, in the words of the Royal Commission. What prevented that being achieved more than anything else was the overlapping responsibilities of various government departments. Now, I just want to conclude, because I've been speaking to you a long time, you've been very tolerant, but I just want to make a few remarks about funding. I don't have time to go through the funding issues in detail because they're intricate. But suffice it to say, I think, that if New Zealand had retained the common law action for damages, we'd all be a great deal worse off, and the scheme would be costing much more but delivering less to fewer injured people. The single most persuasive reason why the original scheme was adopted lay in the fact that it didn't really call for any new money from government. And there was a lot of waste in the old systems. 24-hour cover came at no significant extra cost. And we have to remember that the levies that are now raised on the employers and motor vehicles have their origins in the old insurance systems. There was scepticism, of course, at the beginning, that the costs could be correct. And that was a significant reason why the whole scheme was recosted in the 1969 commentary. But it is at this point, I think, necessary to face the important issue of pay-as-you-go compared with a fully funded scheme. Private insurance schemes have to be fully funded in order to ensure that the insurance company can meet the costs of as the claims run off over time. This can take many years, especially in a scheme that pays benefits for a long time. And in the case of those seriously injured and incapacitated when they're young, that can be a very long time. Actuaries can assess the risks based on the combination of empirical data and assumptions and arrive at assessments of how much must be gathered in order to meet future payments. But governments don't have to do this. They can increase or reduce the levies as things change. Obviously, in a thing like ACC, it's prudent to have substantial reserves in case of catastrophe, so that collecting more than is needed at the beginning is wise, and this is called a partially funded scheme. But clearly, at the beginning of a scheme, there are only a few people who are permanently incapacitated each year, and it takes 15 or more years for the scheme to reach its full cost plateau. And it has to be costed on a plateau because you have to try and estimate now what the plateau will be, when it will be reached, and how much it will cost. Now, that means, of course, if you've got a partially funded scheme, there are substantial funds available for investment. But in discussing the question, the Royal Commission said it was necessary to take in more than was needed in the first few years. It said this: as the scheme will be a government scheme of social insurance, it must in the final resort have the backing of the state. It is for this reason that a formal system of funding cannot be regarded as essential to the stability of the scheme. Those are the Royal Commission words, not mine. The extraordinary gyrations over the funding of the scheme over the years indicate, I think, misunderstandings as to the real nature of the arrangement. Ill-judged changes in policy in New Zealand at various times have caused the cost of the scheme to become items of public controversy, when a more sophisticated understanding and better policies would have avoided those problems. Employers objected in the 1980s to the levies that they were paying because the reserves were being accumulated by the scheme. They had also sought and obtained variable levies rather than the flat rate levies recommended by the Woodhouse report. The 1982 Act removed the requirement that levies should be set on a fully funded basis, allowing future levies to be set on a pay-as-you-go basis. This produced short-term reductions in levies and a subsequent blowout in the levy rates and a running down of the reserves. When the levies had to be put up again as a result, there was further criticism. The result has been that these levies are not regarded so much as a tax as an insurance premium in which the employers and the self-employed have a vital interest. They see it as an opportunity where they can minimise their costs, for example, by reclassifying the risk category into which their staff fall. Related to these efforts by the employers were the efforts that have been made to privatise the scheme. The Accident Rehabilitation and Compensation Insurance Act 1992 was a mean and rather nasty set of amendments to the scheme, most of which did not endure. But the changes included the abolition of lump sum compensation, the payment for partial loss, the introduction of insurance language in the Act, limits on compensation for medical and misadventure, and limits on rehabilitation payments and work capacity testing. And on the top of that was the short-lived experiment that allowed private insurance companies to write insurance for the earner scheme that was passed in 1998 and repealed by the new government in 1999. But the scheme was changed as well in 1998 to provide for full funding, in the sense that I've just been using that. And of course, that was a necessary prelude to privatisation. So when it seems to be that there has been, because of the decision, when the new government came in, they didn't change that requirement. They got rid of privatisation, but they didn't change the fully funding requirement. And that seems to have been because the decision to consolidate the corporation's financial performance onto the Crown's balance sheet. And with the accrual accounting required by the Public Finance Act, this means that the future costs of the scheme and those seriously injured need to be reflected in the government accounts. And I cannot see, however, that this requirement makes a sufficient difference to the fundamentals to justify full funding. Now, there have been suggestions within the last 2 years that the privatisation experiment may be repeated or extended. And although there may be less enthusiasm for that now than there was before the corporation erupted in crisis that produced the resignation of the chief executive, the chairperson of the board and two other directors, those events, of course, precipitated an urgent debate in Parliament on an issue of public importance on the 13th of June 2012. But what happened there was that a new board had been appointed by a minister who had an agenda. He suggested the scheme was a financial mess. Massive increases in levies occurred in 2009, only to be reduced in 2011. And a program of changing the approach to the processing of claims by taking a more restrictive approach was introduced without changing the legal entitlements, which seemed to me rather an assault on the rule of law. And there were significant breaches of privacy by corporation staff that attracted widespread public concern. So what do we make of all of this? More than a generation after the fault system was abandoned and the insurance companies with it, private insurance company administration on a competitive model was argued for and even briefly enacted. It was a triumph of optimism about private enterprise over the very poor New Zealand experience in this very field. While it was asserted such involvement would be superior to the state running a comprehensive system, there's no evidence to support that view. How could it not be wasteful with many companies competing as it was before? How could it not be that the incentives would be to avoid paying people when they deserve to be paid? Do we have to relive the lessons of history in order to believe them? Social insurance is quite a different thing from private insurance. The Woodhouse scheme is about social goals and social purposes in a compassionate society. Some of the attacks by economists on the scheme are full of assertion about inefficiency and moral hazard. But it seems to me a proper understanding of the purpose of the accident compensation reform suggests that privatisation is no more appropriate for accident compensation than for the New Zealand superannuation scheme or indeed Social Security in the United States. I've only got one observation to make in conclusion. The anomaly created by the accident compensation scheme remains. People who are injured are much less generously treated by the state than those who are sick or who suffer from incurable disease or have congenital deformities. We abandoned the common law because it was unprincipled. For the same reason, I wrote in 1977, the unfair and unjust discrimination results because of the choice of benefit depends on the cause of the misfortune. The Law Commission, when chaired by Sir Owen Woodhouse, recommended in 1988 that sickness be covered by the scheme as soon as possible. We are still waiting. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sir Geoffrey, for an interesting and challenging speech. And we're, strictly speaking, out of time. We've got a very tight schedule today, but I thought we'd take one question from the floor, and it needs to be a question and it needs not a speech, and quite brief.
Can it be fixed?
Yeah, I think it can be fixed pretty easily. And I hope that I hope the essential fundamental principles are as clear as a bell. It just is important to follow them.